This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and welcome to Night School, the show that walks you through fundamental concepts in social sciences and humanities. Together with Sharat Kutin, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks, the better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, we are joined by Peter Boschberg. He is Associate Professor in the Department of History at the National University of Singapore and a guest professor in modern history at the University of Greifswald.
Greifswald.
Well, where is Greifswald?
Greifswald is in Germany on the Baltic Sea. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's the fourth oldest university in Germany. One of the reasons I go there is because it was never bombed during World War II, and it still has a university library completely intact with the old prints in it.
How old is it?
It's a 15th century foundation.
Wow.
Middle of the 15th century was when it was originally founded. It was refounded during the 30 Years' War. Greifswald became part of Sweden from the mid-1630s onward, and it was given to Prussia as a result of the post-Napoleonic settlement in 1815. Mm-hmm. So it was, at one stage, also the oldest university in Sweden.
You know, so just that history alone says something about both the enterprise of a historian. You need these archives, you need these old books in order to do your work. The other thing, of course, is just the changing borders in Europe. And of course, you're a historian of European politics, and right? And so, but you've also strayed into Southeast Asia. And as you explained, and you've explained some of the works that you sent us, it's really an extension of your work in Europe.
That's right. I'm essentially a historian of the early modern period. Now, it's the early part of modern history. And as I have to explain to my students in Singapore on a regular basis, modern history from a European vantage point begins either with the discovery of the Americas in the late 15th century, or sometimes they say with the end of the Italian Wars in 1515, when there's a new constellation of power taking place there, and we have the rise of Spain as one of the major European players after that.
And what was going on around this part of the world at that time?
This part of the world is very interesting. We have in the early 16th century the end of the Malacca Sultanate. And we have increasingly Portuguese interference in the eastern part of the Indonesian archipelago. Before that, we have large-scale trading networks operating that had emerged from, let's say, the latter Middle Ages onward, featuring mainly peoples from West Asia, so the Persians, the Arabs, to an extent also the Ottomans, and, of course, the Chinese. And the Ryukyans from what would now be Japan.
Now, you know, you describe yourself as a historian of global interactions of a particular period, the 1500s to the 1900s. Now, what do you do with the idea that part of the world claims to be modern, and another part that you're talking about that actually is intimately connected with it might not, in fact, be modern or consider itself modern? And is that a problem?
I think we have to be very careful with this idea of modern history. It's coined ex post facto. The idea of modern is, of course, that the Renaissance heralds the dawn of a modern era that was distinct and different from the Middle Ages. That is their understanding of modern history. It is not modern in, let's say, a sociological context from the 20th century.
And what is the connection exactly in the work you do between the developments here in that sort of amorphous early modern period and what was happening in Europe? Where do you draw the dots?
Well, it's a matter of looking at, first and foremost, an exchange of goods. In those days, it was luxury goods. Spices always in the early modern period meant medicinal substances. They not just flavor your food, they're also there to cure illnesses. We have things like textiles, certain artifacts, gemstones. And then, of course, there's a limited number of ideas coming as well. And they're being exchanged. It's not just a one-way street.
You know, just going back to your own personal trajectory, so you're trained as a historian. You turn up in Singapore. You're tasked with teaching European history. But you suddenly find something about the place in which you're located that actually interests you intellectually. Could you tell us of that story?
Well, the story of how I got involved in specifically Johor, Malaysian or Malay and Singapore history has to do with a text that I was editing at the time I arrived in Singapore 23 years ago. And when I was reading the text very carefully, trying to find parallels with some of this was working on Grotius, one of the fathers of international law. When I was looking at these texts, I kept stumbling over a place name I would have never recognized when I was living in Europe, but suddenly now had some sort of a knowledge of, and that was Johor. And there were several references to Johor in this text. And I distinctly remember calling up my colleague Paul Kratoska at the time and saying, you know, Paul, hadn't I moved here, I probably wouldn't even know where Johor is. And he kept saying to me, this is really interesting, and what does Grotius have to say about Johor? And I said, oh, it's all scattered all over the place, a couple of sentences here and a couple of sentences there. And he insisted that I put it together in an article. And he badgered me for about 5 years before I did that. And that was my first publication. And it was ultimately titled Hugo Grotius, East India Trade and the Sultan of Johor.
And what was at stake in those references? What did you find from that?
It is the story about how the first Dutch navigators in this part of the world essentially assisted the Dutch in their war effort against the Portuguese. And in this particular incident ended in the seizure of a vessel known as the Santa Catarina off the coast of Singapore on the 25th of February, 1603. The ship and its cargo were taken back to Europe. It was very, very valuable. It caused lots of attention among the merchants, but it also caused a lot of attention in legal circles, especially about the legitimacy of the act. The question had been, in the minds of some people at least, here we have Admiral von Heemskerk taking this Portuguese vessel, but he actually didn't hold a so-called letter of marque, that is a license to rob. And that makes the difference between a pirate and a privateer. A privateer is someone who robs others under the laws of war, with a license, this letter of marque, and a pirate is somebody who does it habitually without any permission to do so from the authorities and not under the laws of war.
That sounds very interesting, the phrase you used there, the laws of war. What were the institutions upholding this? Who recognized it? How was it imagined at that time?
I come from a background in European intellectual history that looked at the theory of the just war. And the theory of the just war has its origins essentially in the Christianization of ancient Rome. Rome has a set of rules about warfare, how it is to be conducted, how it is to be declared, how you treat your enemies. And then, after the Christianization of Rome, there is what you could call an extreme pacifist element. They say you're not allowed to use violence under any circumstances, not even in self-defense. So the just war theory emerges from an attempt to reconcile these two positions. The Roman, I don't want to call it secular, but certainly pagan tradition, and a Christian tradition that espouses extreme pacifism, or alternatively only violence in self-defense. So the just war theories emerge in the course of the Middle Ages through an attempt to reconcile these two. And of course, what happens is there are a number of questions that are being asked. For example, is it permissible ever to wage a war? Is it possible to assist somebody else in a war? Is it possible for me as an individual to fight in a war? These are the questions they needed to answer. By the, let's say, Renaissance period, this had all been worked out quite clearly, and there were certain rules of engagement that applied. You could not wage or start a war without a cause. A cause was not, or let's say greed was not a cause. You needed to have suffered injury first in order to be able to retaliate. And then when you retaliated, there were limits imposed on how much you could take from the enemy if you have vanquished the enemy. There are rules about who is able to declare a war. Not every Tom, Dick, and Harry could do that. You needed to be a sovereign. And the most important thing now, returning to Grotius, is that he develops his theory of sovereignty in the context of the just war theory. And he's answering specifically one question, and that is, who is entitled to declare and start a war?
Can I just roll this thing back a little bit and go back to Johor? Because I think the story of Johor could be elaborated a little bit. One of the things that a paper that you wrote on Admiral Matleaf and his ideas of Singapore, let me just read the title. Admiral Matleaf's Singapore and Johor, 1606 to 1616. In that piece, you referred to Raja Alauddin and Raja Bongsu of Johor. And in it, you talk about agency. You talk about letters they wrote or trade agreements that they bargained hard on. And you kind of make the point about, in some sense, Asian agency, or the agency of those people in somehow the backdrop of these European characters and conflicts.
Well, I suppose the starting point in this are people, not people, are texts from the 19th century, where they essentially treat local Asian overlords as being passive and responsive only to being really seriously nudged by the European powers. When you read these earlier texts from the 16th century, from the 17th century, you realize that these local rulers are very much on the ball, and they're seizing initiatives. In the case of the seizure of the Santa Catarina that I've just elaborated on, it was the Raja Bongsus and the Raja Alauddins who were showing the Dutch the spot where they need to go and sit and wait for the Portuguese ships to come. They're actually showing them that. In the case of Admiral Matleaf, he brought back the surviving members of a diplomatic mission by Johor to the Dutch Republic. We forget that they had direct relations at one stage. And the deal seems to have been that the Dutch should join Johor in a military campaign to oust the Portuguese from Malacca. When Matleaf arrives in May 1606, off the coast of Malacca, he puts the surviving members of the diplomatic delegation ashore and tells them, you go to your king and tell them we're here, we have arrived. And they do that. Raja Bongsu and... No, first, before Raja Bongsu arrives on the scene, you have the Shahbandar of Singapore showing up. He had been sent by the ruler of Johor to check out the situation and to have a look at the Dutch fleet. And he does. He comes with two vessels, and he's going around the ships and having a good look at them and probably counting cannons. And then he went back to Johor to report on this. A few days later, then, Raja Bungsu appears, and they sit aboard the Admiral Motley's vessel, hammering out the agreement for the joint attack. And the conversation that is recorded between the two is absolutely fascinating, because the Dutch propose that they get to keep the town, and the Raja can have all the land outside of Malacca. And he says, why would I want all this land? I already have more land than I can fill with people. No, I want the town. All right. And then he objects again and says something along the lines of, why would I ask you to come and help me in my campaign against the Portuguese so that we kick out the Portuguese and you replace them? That was not the idea.
But this is recorded from the Dutch side, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, unfortunately, we only have the record from the Dutch side, but it's actually, let's say, surprisingly honest, this record. In any case, they signed two treaties, one in May 1606, one in September 1606, and the second one is written after the campaign against Malacca fails. It is written after the campaign fails, the second treaty. And when the next admiral shows up in 1609, he says, how about a fort? How would you like the idea if we built a fort? Because after all, we need to protect you against the Portuguese. And Raja Bungsu says, but my treaty says nothing about a fort. It says warehouses and houses, but nothing about a fort. No fort, sorry. And they write a letter of complaint to the Netherlands saying that this is just simply not on, yeah? So they're really angry about this.
And they write a letter. From their perspective.
And unfortunately, the Malay original no longer exists, but it had been attached with a Dutch translation, which we still have. At least we still have that. But there's lots of agency on part of these rulers. Mm-hmm. They're not passive in responding. They're very much at the forefront of co-opting and initiating. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating stuff. Reached the end of the first half of the show, and we'll be right back. This is Ahmad Fuad Rahmat for BFM Night School. Alongside me is Sharat Kutan, and we are joined this week by Peter Borschberg. This is BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Night School. I am Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, alongside me and Sharat Kutan, and we are joined this week by Peter Borschberg, and we are discussing history, particularly the intersections between local developments and broader developments in Europe. And you told a very fascinating story of the agency of local rulers here, which challenged perceptions of their passivity and their sort of secondary status as movers of the narratives in this part of the world. Batu Sarwar somehow occupies a very interesting location in this time in history. What is it that makes it very intriguing?
I haven't even heard of Batu Sarwar.
Yeah, actually,
and I'm from Johor.
It's the former capital?
It's the former capital.
Is it still called Batu Sarwar today?
There is no more Batu Sarwar.
Okay.
I've gone with a colleague to go and have a look for it, and I think we found it somewhere in a plantation.
Oh, you did find it?
We did find it. We found graves that were part of the old Batu Sarwar setup.
Any relics at all? Architecture?
Only graves.
Mm. And Malaysian archaeologists are exploring this area? No, they're not. You say shaking your head without uttering a single word.
I'm not aware of it. Because, say it like that.
Because in Johor, there's also this other thing. Heredia, the former, I think he was the commander of the 7th Fleet, the Portuguese fleet or something. A Luso
yes.
Malay who built a fort outside of Mua somewhere.
No. That's only a wannabe fort. It was never built.
Oh, I see. It was aspirational.
It's a projection. Or we would call it today an artist's impression.
Oh, I see. Fascinating. Okay, well, he saw miracles above Malacca, so maybe he saw this fort in his dream.
Well, let me try to tie in Heredia and Batu Sarwar. Batu Sarwar becomes the capital after the destruction of Johor Lama in 1587 by the Portuguese, the tendency was that the sultans are moving further and further upstream because they're experiencing attacks, not just from the Portuguese, but from other elements later on. In 1613, for example, the Achenese attack and pretty much burned down the city. Batu Sawar is a fairly large place. We have the only surviving description of its dimensions, to the best of my knowledge, is the one from Motlief, who was there in September 1606. It's described as a fortified city with wooden palisades around it, and on the opposite bank, slightly downstream, is a second settlement that is directly under Raja Bongsu. So it's one of his dependencies, if you so wish. The number of inhabitants, I think, if I'm not mistaken, are estimated at about 4,000 inside the city, but then there's an immediate clarification that actually most residents live outside the walls of Batu Sawar. So it was substantially larger than the 4,000 men who were capable of bearing arms. That's how it's defined as.
So this was a standing army that lived within the fortification?
No. It's just... The definition in Dutch was weerbare mannen, and that would be translated as men who are capable of bearing arms. So they would probably be, you know, upper teens and anybody who was able to rise up and defend the city, basically.
So Batu Sawar then becomes a regional center for trade?
Yes, it does. It's the Dutch have a factory there since 1603, and by factory we mean a billing station. It's a warehouse with a resident agent. Often these warehouses had to be fortified because there was no other way of security and you had valuable goods stored in there, so they needed to be protected. What are they trading? Mostly pepper. Motlief, in fact, shortlists Johor as one of the top locations in Southeast Asia for buying pepper. It didn't necessarily come from Johor. It came mainly from eastern central Sumatra and was brought in from there.
How long was its heyday?
Its heyday, well, I suppose from around the period of the destruction of the previous capital in the late 1580s, and we have good records going at least up until the second decade of the 17th century. And then it seems to disappear, but it comes back again later on in the 17th century. We have the sultans are moving around their residence. They're moving upstream and downstream and to Linga and to Bintan. So depending on when they're residing in the river region, that is when there's a concentration of business and a concentration of the population there.
No,
the Dutch factory gets closed, and at least from the European side, that is when most of the information that we have on Batu Sawar begins to disappear from the European side.
I mean, how important is Batu Sawar in terms of telling the history of this region? And are Malaysian historians kind of like exploring that actively?
It's actually quite important, and I think it's been hitherto underestimated, in fact. Apart from being a very large place for selling and buying pepper, it was also a center of the diamond trade. Now, we know that Raja Bongsu of Johor had personal dependencies on the island of Borneo around Sambas. And the native population from Sambas and further upstream inland in places like Landak and Mempawa were panning for diamonds in the riverbeds. That's how they got them. They weren't mined. It was simply, well, alluvial. Right? It comes with the rainwaters. And of course, it was not sustainable. Once you had panned all the diamonds out of the riverbeds, they were gone.
Malacca occupies particular imaginative inspiration for subsequent court texts of Malay history. Is there any recognition of Batu Sarwar's significance in the same way that it animated the historical affinities of the elite and stuff like that?
Well, the Johor Sultans are telling their European counterparts that they are really the legitimate successors of Malacca. And one of the reasons why they want Malacca back is precisely for that reason, and that they are the true overlords of Malacca, and therefore they want it back.
And what about its, you know, historians often weave a kind of narrative, and modern-day politicians often use those narratives, right, in nation-building and such. Does Batu Sarwar fit into that narrative? Because I've heard Malacca endlessly. Mm-hmm, I've never heard of Batu Sarwar. And I'm 49 years old. And, you know, and I'm not somebody who's, you know, indifferent to these things. So I'm just thinking, is it me, or has, you know, Batu Sarwar been kind of written out, you know, or does it not fit into a particular kind of narrative? Is it not useful?
I don't think it's a question of being written out or deliberately pushed aside. I think it's genuinely a case that people just didn't know. They didn't have the materials at hand. It's now much easier to find materials than it used to be. And even in my case, my goodness, I mean, how many archives do I have to knock off just to get a decent narrative put together? I've been from everywhere, from Lisbon to former East Germany, to look for materials. And in the case of the Batu Sarwar factory that the Dutch had, there's not very many documents left over. When it ceased operations, responsibility for trade in Batu Sarwar then came under the Patani factory in what would now be the south of Thailand. And when that got liquidated, it was transferred up to Ayutthaya in Thailand. Huh? So we don't have very much left. There's just a handful of pages. But what we do have is we have some cargo loadings, and we have some idea what is being traded, how much it was worth, and in what volumes, at least on the Dutch side. And that's really what we have to go by.
So I gather details about cultural life in Batu Sarwar is very scarce as well.
Yes. There are a couple of sources that will tell you about the rich business community that was there. There is another source, a man by the name of Jacques de Coud, who was a young Flemish diamond dealer living in Malacca in the late 16th century and was in Batu Sarwar for trade on several occasions. And I would say after Admiral Motlief, he's probably the second most important source, single source that we have. The rest are small snippets of information that we have to collect together from various reports in Portuguese, in Dutch, in German, in Italian. I reckon there could be a total of about 300 or 400.
Now, you know, when we were speaking earlier about Hugo Grotius, you mentioned ideas and concepts and theories. But in your description of something like the you know, Batu Sarwar as this fort and part of an empire, what do we gather from it? What was the takeaway? Apart from that little story of a time and place, it doesn't seem to have as much significance as the production, say, of, you know, rules of engagement and war and, you know, sort of fundamental concepts that survive till today, like sovereignty and the nation.
What's the significance of this rediscovery for an understanding of Malay history? So what if Batu Sarwar is
all right.
That's
That's a much better. So what? It's significant. It puts Johor at really an important front in international diplomacy in the early 17th century. It is one of the more important centers of trade, specifically in pepper, but to an extent also in diamonds. I think only Sukodana was a better place for trading diamonds at the time. And it tells us a lot about how Johor court politics worked at the beginning of the 17th century. There is quite a bit of talk in Dutch circles about their frustration, one might say, in not being able to navigate exactly who is in charge. Both the Portuguese and the Dutch are explaining that the late father, Raja Ali Jalo, was a strong leader. And they further observe that Johor in the early 17th century was run by four brothers who were obviously competing for different interests and jockeying for power at the time. Alauddin, who is the titular sultan at the time, is not exactly being described as a very strong figure. Raja Bongsu is the one the Dutch like the best, presumably because he was on their side. And Raja Siak seems to be a very shrewd entrepreneur, but the Dutch don't like him because he was doing brisk business with the Portuguese. And finally, Raja Laut, the fourth brother, he seems to be a person who they don't know what to do with. The Dutch don't like him. We're not quite sure who he is. It has been surmised that he might have been the Shabandar of Singapore. It has been speculated that he might have also been the Laksamana of Johor, but we're not sure.
Is it because the royal courts themselves weren't documenting their own history? I mean,
well, it's like a puzzle. You have a certain picture that emerges, but it's never quite complete. And so there is an element of guessing, or at least pinpointing in what directions one might want to look further. But it doesn't mean that these sources are not out there. We just need to be patient to find the right piece that fits in.
What makes history then? It's not just the availability of sources, right? But there are discourses that motivate certain questions that shed light on some the need for some sources more so than others. So it's interesting that this has not fallen on the radar of scholars of this part of the world for so long.
The real art of the historian is asking questions. History is not just about remembering facts. It's about asking questions and interrogating your sources that you have before you. And there are different ways of interrogating these sources, and that is also why we come up with different conclusions depending on what questions we're asking. In the case of something like Batu Sawar, we have very little to go by that is clear, firm documentation. We have few texts that are substantial. We have lots of little bits and pieces, sentences, maybe two sentences, sometimes only a few words to go by. And even then, it's not quite clear always what these sentences or words or texts mean. That is another problem by its own right. So interrogating the sources, formulating questions that can help us move on and understand the situation better is really the art that the historian has to master.
The question that sort of is in my mind now is, you see, the connection between Europe and this part of the world, right? On one hand, you have in Europe this kind of self-consciousness about governance and the rules of engagement in the form of expressed with Grotius about international relations and nation states and stuff. On the Southeast Asian end, is that that same self-consciousness, or do we just do have evidence of that? And if there isn't, why?
When the Dutch are dealing with the Malay powers, they're having a slight difficulty explaining themselves to them. They invent this concept called the King of Holland. And so when the Malay Rajas write to the Dutch, they always write letters to the King of Holland. Now, we know the Dutch nation at the time is an emerging republic. It wasn't planned as a republic. It's just the way it happened. They were looking for a new overlord, and they didn't find one. And to have a country that didn't have a king put them a bit in a bind, frankly. The English didn't have that problem. Portuguese don't have that problem. Spanish don't have that problem, but the Dutch do. And it reminds me of this episode. It's described in Balbi's work from the 1580s. He appears before the King of Burma. Balbi's from the Republic of Venice. And the King of Burma asks him, "Where are you from? Who's your king?" And he said, "Ah, well, we don't have a king." And the King of Burma was so astonished by this statement, he broke out in laughter and was gagging so hard, apparently, that he couldn't breathe anymore. And I think that really says it all. Explaining a republic to a culture that finds it very difficult to conceive of any governmental order outside of the Raja or having a king. It's very difficult. And so they have really a difficulty explaining themselves. And this is something I see in the diplomatic correspondence time and again between the Dutch and the Malay powers on the mainland and Sumatra, Java. They're always having this problem. How do we explain ourselves? Now, inventing this concept of the King of Holland, that took lots of shortcuts. Yeah? Then you didn't have to explain yourself anymore.
Fascinating. So you have actually two different places in the same time zone, as it were, but with such a different conceptual baggage or a set of tools that things have to be invented. Fictional common ground has to be created in order for some sort of negotiation to take place.
It also shows that the Dutch are aware how difficult it is to explain themselves, yeah? That they're going to get the sort of reaction Balbi got, yeah? Trying to explain that his country doesn't have a king. Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, okay. Wow.
They decided to invent a concept.
Yeah, mind blown.
As a form of self-presentation to the rulers in Southeast Asia. That actually had very little to do with realities in Europe.
And that couldn't be checked, but obviously, by the people here. They just took it at face value.
Well, they didn't have direct diplomatic relations by that stage. After 1610, all of the Asian diplomatic relations are essentially farmed out to the Dutch East India Company. So all of the ambassadors, all of the delegates, the missions that are coming, they all go to Batavia then to meet the Governor General. They never go to Europe anymore. There are only, to the best of my knowledge, three missions that made it to Europe in the period before they decided to outsource foreign relations in that way. The first one was the Achenese, second one was Johor, and the third one's the King of Siam.
That's just too much for me and myself to take in. Partly because it feels like the past in this sense is another planet. It really seems to be so different from the kind of realities that we now share globally, isn't it? We share so much common ground. Even if we don't agree with democracy or a caliphate, a la the Islamic State of, Syria and Iraq. We still kind of understand each other. We might, resist it, but we still understand.
We're not going to be rolling on the floor like choking in laughter like the Burmese king.
No, not this. Not now, not in the 21st century. What books would you recommend?
Yes.
Well, there's Undaya's book, Leaves of the Same Tree, that comes to mind. Specifically for the Malay world, the Undayas, of course, have written several books on issues pertaining to Malay sultans and even wrote a history of Malaysia. There are, of course, in terms of, wow, what would I recommend?
Could be a paper too, paper you've written maybe.
You could look in the introduction in my forthcoming book on Motley, if that gives you really an overview about how the Dutch enter the stage in this area and how they are planning to operate with the regional powers and how they decide that they are going to monopolize certain key commodities of trade.
Okay, so that would be an entry.
The new book that's coming.
Okay, so we look forward to that. In fact, we can alert our listeners mm-hmm. to the book when it does, in fact, come off the press.
Yeah, and as usual, if you have any questions to follow up with any of the points brought up in the discussion, you're more than welcome to email us, bfmnightschool@gmail.com, or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School in the search space. Peter, are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not on Twitter.
Facebook? By any chance?
Yes, I am on Facebook, but not publicly.
Okay, but you can email us and we'll forward your questions to Peter, and hopefully you can start learning more about the stuff he's talked about. Peter, thank you so much again for joining us today and sharing your insights. You've been listening to Night School. I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Alongside me is Sharat Kutan, and we were discussing the interesting history of Batu Sawa and questions about how to understand history in a world of difference too. And that was with Peter Boschberg. Thank you for listening. Have a good evening. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.